Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 11, side 1. They threw me brutally against the tree and held me. She came in front of me and I began to blubber in panic, for in that merciless, beautiful face I could see Nariman in the dungeon, Ranavalona staring down from her balcony. The Amazon women, when they caught that poor bastard on the Dahomey Creek, oh God, was she going to set about me? I couldn't bear it, I'd go mad. You needn't cry yet, said the passionless voice. Later. Listen. You sold me to a Navajo animal. I'll not describe what he did to me. I'll just say you're the only man I've hated more. For 2 years I belonged to him. And if I hadn't been a trained whore knowing how degraded men can be, I'd have gone mad or killed myself. Then he died and I was sold to Ute slavers who took me north and amused themselves with me on the way. And sold me among the Blackfeet. There I went through another hell until the Cheyenne raided our village and I was taken as part of the loot and sold to the Sioux in the Black Hills country. Okay? I was in such a drench of fear that I couldn't think of much, but it did occur to me that she hadn't had a much worse time of it than in Susie's brothel, surely. It wasn't as if she'd been kidnapped from a convent. She leaned closer. Do you know what I found among the Sioux? No, how should you? I found kindness. I don't say they're any better than Navajo or Ute or Blackfeet. Only that the man who bought me was a man who was good to me and cared for me and treated me as an honorable woman. Even you may understand what that means. I was 21 and had been used and abused and beaten and raped by hundreds of men. White, Spanish, Mexican, Indian, and a Sioux savage who lived in a filthy tent and could eat raw meat. He treated me like an honorable woman. He wouldn't have understood the word, and I doubt if you do, but to him I was a lady. Yep, his name was Broken Moon Goes Alone. I was his faithful wife for 2 years, although I didn't love him. And when I asked him to let me go back to what I called my own people, he agreed. That was the kind of man he was. He knew I wasn't happy, so he took me to Fort Laramie and sold some robes for $50 and gave it all to me. All he said was, if you come back someday walking, we'll own my teepee and my heart will both be open. I never went back as his wife, but I visited some till he died. And as you see, I have good friends among the Sioux. So these smelly swine gripping me were presumably our bloody cousins-in-law. Okay. Then I started in where I'd have started in Mexico if you hadn't betrayed me. I whored, and as no one knows better than you, I'm good at it. I had my own stable before I was 30, and by the time the war ended, I owned the biggest brothel in Denver. Yep, I still do, and have shares in several other businesses, some of them respectable, but they don't include the Upper Missouri Corporation. That was invented for your benefit. Oh, there's a genuine Bismarck scheme, yep, but I have no part in it. But I knew that there's...
She placed her hands on her hips and swayed her body slightly.
Would be the real bait to get Mr. Comer where I've been wanting him for the past 25 years.
She replaced her scarf round her head and glanced aside to the distant lights of the far west. So close, but for me it might as well have been in New Zealand. Couldn't any of the fools aboard her see or guess or intervene to save me from whatever horror was in store? For it was coming now, and I'd have no chance to plead or lie or grovel. She was determined not to give me the chance, the callous, cold-blooded slut.
You sold me to the Indians, she said quietly. You did the foulest, cruelest thing for $2,000. I'm not getting a cent for you, but I wouldn't take a million to spare you one instant of what's going to happen to you. You sent me to death, or a lifetime of suffering, and it wasn't your fault I survived. So now, you go the way I went. These savages are my friends, and they know the wrong you did me. You know what they do to white men prisoners at the best of times, and with your friend General Custer preparing to butcher them, the times couldn't be much worse. Okay, your suffering won't last as long as mine did, but I'm sure it'll seem a lot longer. I hope so.
I was struggling frantically with those painted devils hanging on to me, but she seemed not to notice. She drew her scarf closer about her shoulders and shivered a little, looking towards the boat. Her voice sounded tired. "I'm going back to the boat now. They'll miss you tomorrow, and I'll insist on a search, but Captain Marsh won't dare neglect his duty to the expedition for long. And I'll be able to sleep alone again. When I was a young girl, new in the trade, I sometimes used to cry out against God. Was this what you made me for? Is this what you meant for me, God? At its worst, it was better than the last few weeks when I played the whore to get you here." She glanced at me incuriously. "Strange to think I once did it for love. The only man I ever loved. You shouldn't have done that to me. In Santa Fe." She turned and walked away beneath the trees, the tall, graceful figure receding quickly into the shadows. The Sioux dragged me away from the tree and ran me into the woods, away from the river. Chapter 20. I still say that if it hadn't been for that damned gag, I'd have been back on the Far West before midnight, rogering her speechless. And she knew it, too, and must have arranged for my abductors to muzzle me first go off, so that I'd never get a word in edgeways to sweetheart her. You see, however much they loathe you, whatever you've done, the old spark never quite dies. Why, for all her hate, she'd blubbered at the mere recollection of our youthful passion, and for all she said, our weeks on the boat could only have reminded her of what she'd been missing. No, she knew damn well that if once she listened to my blandishments, she'd be rolling over with her paws in the air. So like old Queen Bess with the much-maligned Essex chap, she daren't take the risk. Pity, but there it was. I confess these speculations weren't in my mind just then as they dragged me through the dark woods, hammering me when I stumbled and thrust me astride a pony. Then it was off, up a gentle slope with those four monsters round me. I was near suffocating with the gag, which didn't assist thought as I tried to grapple with the impossibility of what had happened. Yet I knew it wasn't impossible. Mrs. Candy was clearly come back like Nemesis. Once the patch was off and she'd whispered that snatch of her French riding song in her old voice, I'd have known her beyond doubt. I couldn't marvel at not recognizing her earlier, even at the closest quarters. She'd grown, for one thing, filled out admirably, and the brash, hard Mrs. Candy was as different from the dove-like Creole as could be, in speech and manner. Aye, and nature. I suppose that's what 25 years of being bulled by redskins and whoring on the frontier and acquiring bordellos does to you. Not surprising, really. Even so, she'd played it brilliantly, hadn't she, just keeping me at arm's length, the Bismarck nonsense, galloping me westward to the very spot where she could deal me out poetic justice. Spiteful bitch. What simpler than to send word to her Sioux friends, doubtless with a handsome fee, and have them scout the boat along the Yellowstone, ready at her signal to pounce on the unsuspecting victim and shanghai him into the hills to stick burning splinters in his tenderer parts. Neat, but not gaudy. Simplicity itself compared to some of the plots that have been hatched all over me by the likes of Lola and Lincoln and Otto Bismarck and Ignatieff and... Oh, God, I've had some rotten luck. What I couldn't fathom, though, was how the devil she'd discovered that the much-respected Flashy of 76 was the long-lost B.M. Comer of 49. She'd heard, she said, but from whom? Who was there still who'd known me as Comer in the earlies, had recognized me now and tipped her the wink? Spotted Tail? Why, he'd never heard the name Comer in his life. I'd been windbreaker to him from 50. And what should he and Mrs. Candy know of each other? Susie, Maxwell, Wooten and the like I could dismiss. I hadn't seen them, or they me, in quarter of a century, supposing they were still alive. Carson was dead. No one in the army knew about Comer. Lincoln was dead. But I was a fool to be thinking of folk I remembered. There must be hundreds I'd forgotten who might still remember me, and seeing Flashy promenading down Broadway would exclaim, "Comer, be God!" Old Navy men, perhaps a returned emigrant from the wagon train, a Cincinnati invalid. Someone out west, like a Laramie hunter or trader. Susie's whores, by thunder, they'd know me, and if Clanny was anything to go by, the graduates of Mrs. Willink's Academy might be running half the knocking shops in America by now. Aye, and corresponding with the other old girls. Devil a doubt. Dearest Clanny, you'll never guess who called in for a rattle at our shop the other day. 'Twas such a start. Tall, English, distinguished, fine whiskers. Give up. How many of the bawdy houses I'd frequented had black madams? Difficult, but that would be it, like as not. These were random thoughts, you understand, floating up through stupefied terror from time to time. The point was that four damnably hostile Sioux were bearing me into the wilderness with murderous intent, and if there was one thing I'd learned in a lifetime of hellish fixes, it was the need to thrust panic aside and keep cool if there was to be the slimmest chance of winning clear. Once we'd skirted the high bluff and reached the rough upland, they're headed southwest by the stars. It might be they'd go a safe distance and then set to roasting me over a slow fire, but I doubted it. They were riding steady, so it looked like a longish trek across the northern powder country towards the Bighorn Mountains. That was where the Sioux were mostly hanging their hats these days. Somewhere far off to my left, up the Rosebud, Custer would be starting his long swing south and west to roughly the same destination. I was pinning no hopes on him, though. The last man you want riding to the rescue is G.A.C., for there'll be blood on the carpet for certain. And the more I thought, the more my hope grew of emerging from this pickle, peaceful-like. After all, Mrs. Candy wasn't the only one with chums among the Sioux. I spoke the lingo. I could cite Spotted Tail as a bosom pal. And even if he was far away, there must be hostiles who'd remember me from Camp Robinson, and who might think twice about dismembering a U.S. Treaty Commissioner just to please the former squaw Broken Moon goes alone. Certainly they'd not be well disposed to anyone white just now, and given a prisoner, they're more likely to take a long, thoughtful look at his innards than not. But again, I might buy my way clear or get a chance to play my real trump card. Somewhere up ahead, and the nearest thing to God between Canada and the Platte, was Tashunka Witko Crazy Horse, and while I hadn't seen him since he was 6, he wouldn't let them snip pieces off a man who'd practically dandled him on his knee, surely. I put these points to my captors at our dawn halt, when they had to remove my gag to let me drink and eat some jerked meat and corn mush. I suggested that the cleverest thing they could do would be to return me to the fire canoe on the Yellowstone, where I'd see they got safe conduct and all the dollars they wanted from Many Stars soldier Terry. They listened in ominous silence. Four grim, blanketed figures, with the paint smeared and faded on their ugly faces, and not a flicker of expression except pure malice. Then their leader, one Jacket, started to lambast me with his quirt, and the others joined in with sticks and feet, thrashing me until I yelled for mercy, and didn't get it. When they were tired and I was black and blue, Jacket stuffed the gag back brutally, kicked me again for luck, and stooped over me, his evil grinning face next to mine. "You have two tongues. You are not American, although you sat with the liars at White River. You are the Washechuska windbreaker who sold my brother's woman, Walking Willow, to the Navajo who shamed her. You are going to die, Kakeshia."
Torture.
He launched into a description that could give me nightmares even now, and took another hack at me. "Spotted Tail, a woman and a coward. We'll send him a gift of your... since he seems to have lost his own." The others howled with glee at that and threw me onto the pony with more blows and taunts. And now I knew real fear, as I realized that I was tasting the temper of the hostile Sioux, the merciless, desperate savages who stood beyond the law, who were not going to be rounded up onto the agencies, who loathed everything white and despised Spotted Tail as a traitor, and who were preparing, with all the hate and fury Custer could have wished, to meet whatever the Americans might send against them. One white captive wasn't going to buy or bully his way out of their clutches. Torturing him to death would be a momentary amusement on the way to better things. All day we rode southwest over the bare country east of the Bighorn. Even allowing for my jaundiced eye, it was neither a grand nor memorable prospect, just endless low hills and ridges of yellow grass, with a few trees here and there, and the outline of mountains far in the distance. A few vivid pictures stay in my mind. A buffalo skeleton picked clean in a gully. A hawk that lingered above us for hours in the blazing afternoon. A party of Sans Arc Sioux who crossed our trail and yelled exultant news of a great victory over the Grey Fox Crook to the south. Not a word of Custer, though, which seemed odd, for he must be well up the Rosebud by now. Then, on, over those endless sparse hollows and hills, with the grasses blowing in the wind, while my body ached with ill usage and weariness, and my unaccustomed backside must have rivaled the setting sun. My thoughts, well, I don't care to dwell on them. I remembered the fate of Gallant in Scalp Hunters, and Sancerre laughing merrily over the details. We lay that night in a gully, and every joint in my aging body was on fire when we rode on next morning. Ahead of us there were bluffs now, and in the gullies we met occasional parties of Indians, hunters and women with burdens, and a few boys running half-naked in the bright sunshine, playing with their bows, their voices piping in the clear air. I caught a glimpse of a river down below us to the left, and presently we reached the top of the bluffs. My guards were whooping and calling to each other in delight, and as my pony jolted to a halt, I raised my tired head and saw such a sight as no white man had ever seen in the New World. I was the first, and only a few saw it later, and most of them didn't see it for long. Directly below us the placid river wound in great loops between fine groves of trees in a broad valley bottom. On our side the valley was enclosed by the bluffs on which we stood, although to our right the bluffs became a ridge, running away for a couple of miles into the hazy distance. From the bluffs to the river the ground fell pretty steeply, but from the crest of the long ridge the slope was much more gentle, a few hundred yards of hillside down to the river, with a few gullies and dry courses here and there. It's like any other hillside, very peaceful and quite pretty, all clothed in pale yellow grass, like thin, short wheat, with a few bright flowers and thistles. All ordinary enough, but I suppose there are a few old Indians who think of it now as others may think of Waterloo or Hastings or Bannockburn. They call it the greasy grass. But I barely noticed it that morning, for on the opposite bank of the river was a spectacle to stop the breath. Anyone from my time has seen Indian villages, a few score lodges, sometimes a few hundred perhaps, covering the space of a cricket field. But here, in splendid panorama, was a town of teepees that must have covered close on 10 square miles. As far as I could see, the bank was a forest of lodges, set in great tribal circles, from the thick woods upstream to our left, to the more open land farther down opposite the greasy grass slope, and from the groves by the water's edge back to a low tableland in the distance, where a great pony herd grazed. It was the largest assembly of Red Indians in history, and while I couldn't know that, I was sufficiently awestruck. Were those the few dispersed bands of hostiles I'd heard lightly spoken of, the fag end of the once mighty Sioux Confederacy, which Terry and Gibbon had been afraid might melt away and escape? The thousand or two who weren't worth bringing up the Gatlings for? I saw Custer's face turned in impatience to lonesome Charlie Reynolds. We're much more than a match for them if they were all together. Well, they were all together with a vengeance. There must be 10,000 of the red buggers down there, if there was one. Who the devil could they all be? I didn't know, but all America knows now. Hunk Papa, Sanzark, Brule, Oglala, Miniconju, the whole great roll call of the Dakota Nation, with Arapaho, Blackfeet, Stoney, Shoshone, and other lesser detachments from half the tribes of the North Plains and Shining Mountains. And not forgetting my old acquaintances, the Cheyenne. Never forget the Cheyenne. But 5 or 10,000, Charlie, it made no difference. Everyone knew they weren't going to fight. Not they. Not Sitting Bull, or Crazy Horse, or Two Moon, or Brave Bear, or Lame White Man, or Bobtail Horse, or White Bull, or Calf, or Roan Horse, or a few thousand others. Especially not the ugly little gentleman whom I had put up for membership of the United Service Club, if I had my way, since he was the best soldier who ever wore paint and feathers, damn him. His name was Gore. Well, there they were, all nice and quiet in the morning sun, with the smoke haze hanging over the vast expanse of teepees, and the women and kids down at the water's edge, washing or playing. But I didn't have long to look at it. For Jacket led us on to a ravine that ran down from the bluffs opposite the centre of the great camp. Only later did I learn that it's called Medicine Tail Coulee, and that the river, which is hardly deep enough to drown in, and half a stone's throw across, was the Little Bighorn. The ford from the coulee to the camp was only a few inches of water above a stony bed. We splashed over and under the cottonwoods on the far bank, where women and children came running to see. But Jacket pushed ahead to the first line of teepees, beyond a flat open space where fires burned and dogs prowled among the litter. And we dismounted before a big lodge with a few braves lounging outside. The stink of Indian and wood smoke was strong, inside as well as out. Jacket thrust me into the dim interior and cut my wrist cords, but only so that he could tie my numbed hands to the ends of a short wooden yoke, which his pals laid across my shoulders. He thrust me down into the rubbish on the teepee floor and shouted, and a girl came in. "This one," growls Jacket, "he's a dirty lump of white buffalo dung who is to die by inches when the one who catches has seen him. Has he come yet?"
"No, Jacket," says the girl. "He was in the south where the fighting was with the grey fox 7 days ago. Perhaps he will come soon."
"Until he dies, this one must speak to nobody. Take the gag from his mouth now and give him such scraps as the dogs have left. If he speaks," says he, glaring at me, "I will cut off his lips."
And he drew his knife and threw it point first into the earth beside my foot. His pals crowed, and beyond them I could see curious faces peeping through the teepee flap. Come to see the interesting foreigner, no doubt. The girl fetched a bowl of water and a platter of corn and meat, knelt by me, and removed the gag from my burning mouth. But for two or three short intervals it had been there for the best part of 36 hours, and I couldn't have spoken if my life depended on it. I gulped the water greedily as she put the bowl to my lips, and when Jacket growled to stop, she went on pouring without so much as a glance at him, until I'd sucked the last drop dry. As she spooned the food into me, I took a look at her, and noted dully that she was pretty enough for an Indian, with a wide mouth and tip-tilted nose, which suggested that some frog voyager had wintered among the Sioux 15 years back. She was very deft and dainty in her spooning, and Jacket got quite impatient, pushing her aside before I was finished, and shoving the gag back as roughly as he knew how. He bound it in place with a rawhide strip, and soaked the knot, the vicious swine, just to make sure no one could untie it.
"Keep him that way till I come again," says he,
and kicked me two or three times before swaggering out with his pals, leaving me in a state of collapse on the scabby buffalo rug against the teepee side. The girl collected her dishes and went out, without telling me to ring if I wanted anything. I was in despair and rage at my own stupidity. In my folly, I'd destroyed my best chance by pitching my tail prematurely to Jacket, offering him bribes, urging acquaintance with Crazy Horse and so on. I couldn't have done worse, for Jacket, either out of brotherly affection for Clearney, or for what she'd paid him, wanted me dead and damned, and was going to make good and sure that I had no second chance of stating my case to less partial Sioux, who might have been disposed to listen. I was to be kept gagged and helpless until this mysterious person whom Jacket had mentioned, who was it, the one who catches, came to have a look at me, and then presumably I'd be toted out to be strung up and played with for the amusement of the populace, none of whom would know who I was, or care for that matter. God, that implacable bitch, Cleone Candy had done for me with a vengeance. She and her stinking relatives. I lay palpitating in the dim lodge, wondering if when next they fed me I'd get a chance to yell for help, and what good it might do if I did, and what were the chances of Terry and Gibbon's little army arriving, and what might happen then. This camp, after all, was their target if they could find it, but they must, for their scouts would see it smoke 10 miles away, and there was bound to be a parley, for neither side could take the risk of precipitate attack. And if they parleyed, I felt my hopes rise. When had Gibbon figured to come up with the hostiles? The 26th. I forced my numb mind to calculate the days since we'd left Rosebud. This must be the 24th. If I could stay alive for 48 hours and Gibbon's column got here, and I could get my mouth open to some half-friendly ear... The tippy flap parted, and the girl came in again. She glanced at me and then began pottering with some utensils in a corner. I scrambled to my feet with that damned yoke galling my neck, and as she looked round, I ducked my head in the direction of the water pitcher and tried to look appealing. She glanced towards the flap and then back at me. I can't say she looked sympathetic, for her face was strained and tired, and her eyes empty. But after a moment she motioned me to sit down again, filled a bowl with water, and with some difficulty slipped free the rawhide strap that held the gag. She eased it out, and I gasped and sucked at that blessed water, easing the pain on my parched lips and tongue. I wish to God I looked more presentable, for now I saw she was decidedly comely, with her boyish figure in its dark green tunic, her slim hands and ankles, and that saucy little face that seemed so woebegone. Given a shave and a comb and a change of linen, I could have cheered her up in no time. But seeing my eyes on her, she made a little sign for silence, glancing again towards the entrance. I spoke quietly. It came out in a croaking whisper. "What's your name, kind girl with the pretty face?" She gasped in surprise at hearing Sue.
"Walking blanket woman,"
says she, her eyes wide.
"Oglala?"
She nodded.
"You know the chief Tashunka Witko?"
Again she nodded, and I could have kissed her as my spirit soared.
"Listen quickly. I am the Washachutska windbreaker, friend of your chief's uncle, Sinte Galeska of the Burned Thighs. This evil man Jacket intends to kill me, although I am a friend to your people."
"Washachutska, what is that?"
says she.
"You are an Isantanka bad man, one of our enemies."
"No, no, my tongue straight. Go to your chief quickly. Your tongue is double."
I was startled at her fierceness and the flash of sudden anger in her eyes.
"You have done great wrong. Jacket told me all Isantanka white men are our enemies."
Before I knew it, she'd stuffed the gag back into my potato trap and was hauling the rawhide up into place, while I tried to jerk my head free. But she was strong for all her daintiness and cursed me something fearful, with little sobs among the swear words.
"I was a fool to pity you."
She gave the strip a final tug and then clouted me over the ear. She knelt in front of me, her little face grim as she choked back her tears.
7 days ago your Isan Honska long knives killed my brother in the grey fox fight. That is the kind of friends your people are. I was a fool to give you water and let you open your snake's mouth. Why should I be sorry for you?"
And damn it, she clocked me again and flounced away, clattering her pots and wiping her eyes. Of all the infernal luck, womanly sympathy one minute, and the next she was battering me because her ass of a brother had got himself killed against Crook. I struggled with my yoke and scrabbled my feet in what I hoped was a coaxing, reasonable way, but she never gave me another look, and presently went out again. Well, that was another hope dashed, temporarily. If I was patient, her natural kindness might revive, brother or no. My powers of persuasion with the female sex are considerable, and even with my scrubby chin and dishevelled locks and tattered clobber, the remains of full evening dress, God help us, in a Sioux teepee, I knew I could charm this little looker if she'd only listen. Ain't it odd? Twice in as many days I'd been prevented by speechlessness from exercising my arts on unfriendly females. It never rains, but it pours. I thought I'd get another chance when they fed me again, but they didn't. Jacket looked in once for a kick at me, but no suggestion of dinner, and I lay there miserably as evening came, and outside the drumming and chanting began. They were holding a scalp dance for the rosebud fight, I believe. But I was barely conscious of the din, for despite the cramping agony of my yoke and my other aches, I fell into an uneasy doze, half filled with horrid pictures of one-eyed women and painted faces and captives bound to burning stakes, who looked uncommon like me in hussar uniform. A Saturday night it was, too. It was birdsong that woke me, and sunlight through the teepee flap, catching the corner of my eye, which was drowsily pleasant for a moment, until a harsh voice jarred me back to my plight. There were half a dozen Indians in the teepee, looking down at me with stony indifference. The one who was talking was Jacket, and he seemed to be exhibiting me.
When the one who catches has seen him, he will go to the fire. It is the wish of my brother's wife, and mine, and our families.
He spoke as though challenging contradiction, but he didn't get any.
Whoever he says he is, he deserves to die by Kakashia. Who says he is a friend of Spotted Tails anyway?
Who cares? Says another, a burly ruffian with his belly hanging over his waistband and shoulders like an ox. His face was huge and ugly, but not without a humour that I was in no state to appreciate. His leggings and jacket were red, and he carried a short war bonnet in his hand. Do what you like with him. He's white, says this callous brute. Come on, Totanka Yotanka is back from the hill. He has been seeing. He gave a grunting laugh. Pity he can't see some buffalo. If I'd known then that the speaker was Gaul, the Honk Papa chief I mentioned earlier, I might have been impressed, but probably not. For there was only one of the half dozen who claimed attention. He alone had no war bonnet or feathers, or anything but a coloured shirt. He was young and wiry, lean-faced and lank-haired, and without paint. But with those eyes he didn't need any. For a moment I wondered if he was blind or in a trance, for he gazed straight ahead unseeing. I doubted if he even knew where he was. His shirt was blue-sleeved and gold-coloured, with a great yellow band on which was a red disc, and its sleeves and shoulders were fringed with more scalps than I'd care to count. When Jacket tapped his arm, he turned those staring blank eyes on me, but without any change of expression. It made my skin crawl, and I was glad when they trooped out, Jacket taking another kick at me on the way. He liked kicking me, no error. I got no breakfast that morning either, possibly on Jacket's instructions, possibly because she was still peeved at me. Walking blanket woman didn't look near for several hours, by which time I could hear all the bustle and stir of the great camp, voices and laughter and kids yelling and a bone flute playing and dogs barking and the smell of kettles and me famished. Even when she arrived, she was decidedly cool and wouldn't remove my gag. It was only by piteous eye-rolling and head-ducking that I got her to relent sufficiently to pour water over my gagged mouth, so that I could obtain some refreshment. She raised no objection when I humped my yoke over to the flap and took a cautious peep at the outside world. It must have been just after noon of Sunday, June the 25th, 1876. I wondered if Elspeth was in church at Philadelphia, examining the hats and pretending attentive approval of the sermon. I could have wept at the thought, and how my foolish whoremongering had brought me to this awful pass. God, what an idiot I'd been! And that bitch Candy would be bedding one of the stokers on the Far West, no doubt. Fine subjects for Sabbath meditation, you see. But they don't matter. What I did and saw that afternoon, or what matter? And I relate it as clearly and truthfully as I can. All was calm in that part of the village between my teepee and the river. There was a fairish crowd of Indians doing what Indians usually do, squatting and loafing, scratching and gossiping in groups, some of the bucks painting, the women cooking at the fires, the kids scampering. There was a slow general drift upstream. That, I'm told, is where Sitting Bull's camp circle of Hunk Papa was, with the other tribal groups strung out downstream, ending with the Cheyenne at the bottom limit, out of sight to my left as I peeped towards the river. Where exactly my teepee was, I've never quite determined. All sorts of maps have been drawn of that camp, and I believe I must have been in a lodge of the Sands Arc circle close by the river. But Walking Blanket Woman was an Oglala, so God knows. Certainly the ford was to my right front, perhaps 100 yards off, and above the trees I had a fair view of Medicine Tail Coulee running up into the bluffs on the far shore. Walking Blanket Woman spoke suddenly at my elbow.
"Take a good look, White Face," says she, pretty sullen. "Soon they will be looking at you. The one who catches will come today, and you will be burned. Maybe other white snakes will be burned too, if they come any closer."
And off she went, clattering her pots, leaving me to wonder what the devil she meant. Had Terry's force been sighted, perhaps? If Gibbon had force-marched, he could be here today. Custer and his blasted seventh must be roaming off in the blues somewhere, or he'd have been here already. If only I could ask questions. "The hawk stoops, but in the grass the rabbit does not lift his head. He runs, but does not see. The hunter waits, and the quarry is unaware. They come from the rising sun. Will any meet them, the hunter with his bow and long lance?" It was an old man singing in a high, keening wail as he shuffled by, face upturned and eyes closed, dirty white hair hanging over his blanket. He had a pot from which he dabbed vermilion on his cheeks in spots as he sang. Then, from a medicine bag, he shook dust on the ground either side. The people fell silent, watching him. Even the kids stopped their row. "Who are the braves with high hearts? Who sings his death song? Is it the young hunter shading his eyes as he looks to the east? But the sun is high now, it shines on both the hawk and the quarry." The thin voice died away, and a great stillness seemed to have fallen on the camp. I ain't being fanciful, it was like the silence after the last hymn in church. Out in the heat haze they were standing in silent groups, women, children, braves in their blankets or breech clouts, some with their faces half-painted. They were looking upstream through the trees, but at nothing that I could see. Over the river the bluffs were empty, except for a few children playing on the greasy grass slope to the left. The woods around us were quiet, and no birds sang now. A dog yelped in the distance. A few ponies under the care of a stripling snuffled and stamped. The crackle of a fire 50 yards away was audible, and the soft murmur of the little bighorn meandering through its fringe of cottonwoods. I'll never forget that silence, as though a storm were coming. Yet the sky was clear, midsummer blue, with the least fleecy drift of high clouds. Somewhere on the right, away towards the Hunk Papa circle, there was a soft mutter of sound, a rustle as of distant voices growing, and then a shout, and then more shouting, and the low throb of a drum. People began to move up that way, the braves first, the women more slowly, calling their children to them. Voices were raised in question now, feet moved more quickly, stirring the dust. The hum of distant voices was a clamour, rippling down towards us as the word passed. Indistinct, but of growing urgency. Crouched under my yoke just inside the teepee, I wondered what on earth it could be. Walking Blanket Woman pushed past me, and then, from the trees up to the right, there was a scatter of people, and I heard the yell, "Pony soldiers! Long knives coming! Run, run quickly! Pony soldiers!" In a moment it was chaos. They ran like startled ants, brave shouting, women screaming, children rolling underfoot, all in utter disorder, while the yells from upstream increased, and then came the distant crack of a shot, and then a fusillade, and then the running rattle of irregular firing, and to my disbelieving ears the faint note of a bugle sounding the charge. At this the panic redoubled. They milled everywhere, with some of the braves yelling to try to restore order, and the mob of women and children surging past downstream. The men were trying to herd them away, and at the same time shouting to each other, and with mothers crying for their children, and vice versa, and the wiser heads trying to give directions. It was bedlam. The crash of distant firing was continuous now, and to my right I could hear the whoops and war cries of men running to join the fight, wherever it was. One thing was sure, it wasn't Gibbon. If he came at all, it would be from my left, downstream. This was all up at the southern end of the valley, and there were pony soldiers. Christ, it could only be Custer. And 700 strong against this enormous mass of hostiles. No, it might be Crook, hitting back after his reverse at the Rosebud. That was far more likely, and he had twice as many men as Custer. Perhaps it was both of them. 2,000 sabres. The Sioux would have their hands full if that were so. It wasn't, of course. It was Reno obeying orders, coming full tilt towards the Hunk Papa circle along the bank with 100-odd riders. And I called Raglan a fool. Across my front, braves were hurrying upstream. One young buck was strapping on 2 6-guns as he ran, and a girl hurried after him with his eagle feather. He was shouting as she thrust it through his braid, and then he was away, and she standing on tiptoe with her knuckles to her mouth. 2 more braves I saw tumbling out of a teepee, one with a lance, and his face painted half red, half black, and an old man, an old woman, hobbling behind them, the old fellow with an ancient musket, which he was calling to the boys to take, but they never heard, and he stood there holding it forlornly. Another old woman hurried by with a small boy. The bundle she was carrying burst open, and they both paused to scrabble in the dust until the kid shrieked and pulled the old girl aside, as a thunder of hooves came from my left, and out from beneath the trees came as fine a sight, I speak as a cavalryman, you understand, as one could wish, a horde of feathered, painted braves, lances and rifles aflourish, whooping like bedamned boulets and miniconju, I think, but I'm no expert. And then there was another yell somewhere behind my teepee, and by humping out for a look I could see another mob of feathered friends making for the river to Oglala, I fancy, and everywhere there were braves on foot with bows and rifles and hatchets and clubs, racing towards the sound of the firing, which was growing fiercer, but I thought no nearer. The Brule riders were thundering by before me, shrieking their "Gai gai 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 yig" and "Hooray!" And if you ever hear that from a Sioux, get the hell out of his way, because he isn't asking you the time. The only worse noise he makes is "Hoon," which is the equivalent of the Zulu "Siji," and signifies that he's sticking steel into someone. Out before my tippy was the old singer, waving his arms and bawling, "Go, go, Lakotas, it's a good day to die." There's a kindred spirit, thinks I. He wasn't going, but the rest of them were, by gum, horse, foot, guns, bows, and every damn thing. These were the Sioux who weren't going to fight, you recall. They vanished among the trees upstream, and the women and kids were away down in t'other direction by now, which left the world to sunlight and to me, more or less. Suddenly there was hardly a soul in sight between me and the river. A few stragglers, 1 or 2 old men. The ancient singer who had stopped encouraging the lads and was making tracks to his teepee. Upstream the firing was banging away as loud as ever, but I didn't care for it. The boys in blue were making no headway at all. If anything, the crash of musketry was receding, which was damn discouraging. Now, 2 things I must make clear. First, that I'd not merely been viewing the stirring scene, but considering keenly which way salvation lay, and deciding to lie low.